This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Golf is considered one of the most quiet, reflective, and polite sports, except when actor and comic Bill Murray is on the golf course. He became famous in the golf world for his shenanigans playing on the Pro-Am golf circuit, which brings together pros and celebrities. He literally tore up the golf course in his movie Caddyshack, in which he played the groundskeeper of the course. Murray used to caddy as a kid. Now he has a new book called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. The title refers to his monologue from Caddyshack. In this scene from Caddyshack, he's providing his own color commentary as if he's competing in the Masters, but instead of a golf club, he has a sickle, and what he's swinging at is chrysanthemums.
The crowd is standing on its feet here at Augusta, the normally reserved Augusta crowd, going wild. For this young Cinderella, who's come out of nowhere, he's got about 350 yards left. He's going to hit about a 5-iron, I expect, don't you think? He's got a beautiful backswing. Dad! Oh, he got all of that one. He's got to be pleased with that. The crowd is just on its feet here. He's a Cinderella boy. Tears in his eyes, I guess, as he lines up this last shot. He's got about 195 yards left, and looks like he's got about an 8-iron. This crowd has gone deadly silent. Cinderella Story, out of nowhere, a former greenskeeper now about to become the Masters champion.
It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole!
Hey, young fella, I was hoping to squeeze in 9 holes before this rain starts.
Certainly, Your Eminency.
Take my bag, huh?
Certainly, Your Magnificence.
Okay, come on, chop chop.
So how old were you when you started working at golf clubs?
10.
And what was your first job?
I was a shag boy.
What does that mean?
It's not an Austin Powers thing.
Yeah, it sounds kind of dirty, doesn't it?
Yeah, you would drop a bag of golf balls on a practice tee, and then you just run out into somewhere out there. And the player would practice and hit the balls, and you had to fetch them like a dog out there. And sometimes they'd go for a half an hour, sometimes they'd go for an hour, sometimes they'd go for an hour and a half. And when he hit all the balls, you ran back in, dropped them in front of him, and ran back out. It was Cocker Spaniel work, but you're outside, and as long as you didn't drift off and get, you know, your mind, you could get hit, you know, your mind could wander. I started doing it like it was like I was playing the outfield or the infield or something. I'd try to retrieve them all before they stopped moving. You know, I'd get the break. I'd get the Mickey Mantle jump on it and go for it. And so that kept me amused for a while. But
I think your brothers were already working at the golf club when you started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my oldest brother, Edward, started there. And he really was slavishly devoted to golf. He got into it very seriously. And he still is. And now his children are. He worked his way through the caddying ranks till he worked in the pro shop, and then he got a caddy scholarship to go to college. My other brother, Brian, he worked his way as a caddy until he earned enough money to buy cigarettes, and then he worked on playing cards and perfecting his cursing. But they both turned out okay, considering. But so I was little Murray, I guess, when I showed up.
And how old were you when you were big enough to start caddying?
I think I was 11 and a half when I finally got a K, in there, 12. But, I mean, I carried singles until I was 13, which means you carried one bag. And then when I was 13, I started carrying doubles. And then so when I carried two bags. And then you get paid twice as much, which wasn't very much. And you have to take care of two people while you play.
You were a greenskeeper in the movie Caddyshack. And in Caddyshack, it was part of your assignment to kill the gophers that were tearing up the green on the golf course. Did you ever have to do that, worry about gophers?
Well, they needed me on that wall, Terry. I didn't have to do it ever, but I was there once when it was done. There were gophers that were burrowing into the side of a green. And I wasn't there when it happened, but they had put poison into their warren or whatever it is, and we were there to see these little baby gophers stumble out, you know, for their last sunrise. It was, you know, not I mean, I didn't fall apart or anything, but it was, you know, you don't want to see anything die. And little baby gophers, that was kind of tough. But yeah, so that's my, that was, you know, I was, that was method acting, if that's what your question was.
Yes.
I've done that before, and I was calling upon that.
The emotional memory.
Mm-hmm.
In Caddyshack, your most famous scene is the scene when you're basically doing your own color commentary for yourself. You're the greenskeeper imagining yourself a big golf pro star. What kind of feedback do you get from golfers about that movie and particularly that scene?
Well, everybody's done it. I mean, a lot of the things I've done in that film are things that every kid has done while talking himself through his own practice time or his own playing alone time. You know, you hear players say, when they make a great shot or a great play at the end of a game, they say, well, I've done that 1,000 times practicing. Well, you know, and they narrated it, too, at the same time. You know, but people, there's something about the movie Caddyshack that touches people. And when I look at it now, I watched it the other night, and it's hard to turn off or walk away from when it starts because it's engaging, and there aren't many movies about golf, and it fills that niche. And it's also some sort of movie about class or status or something, you know. So it has a Prince and the Pauper feel, something like that, and so it appeals to people at that level because, you know, when you talk about golf being a certain kind of person's game, certainly, well, one of the gripes is that it's a rich person's game. You know?
No, I think that Caddyshack was written, or at least co-written, by your brother Brian Doyle Murray.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any in-jokes from your years together working on the golf course that ended up in the movie?
Well, sure. There was there's various people that are portrayed in the movie that are the actual names of the people we used to caddy for. Like Mr. and Mrs. Haverkamp was this deadly pair of 36 handicap golfers, which is the legal limit. You can't get higher than 36 for a man and 40 for a woman, and they were that. And they had matching gray bags, and you know, if you'd be given your loop, as it was called, your job, it was sort of like a trucker bringing out whatever truck he's driving this morning or something, and you'd come out of the pro shop carrying these identical gray bags, and the caddies would just go wild because you had the Haverkamps. And you had what was basically a day's job getting them around the course. You know, they're very nice people, but a terrifying game. You could never try to walk ahead of them because the ball could go in any direction. And it was just going to take you all day to finish 18 holes.
Bill Murray is my guest, and he's written a new book called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. Now, I understand you're going to be in the new movie The Cradle Will Rock.
Yes, I've already done it.
You've already done it. Mm-hmm. Is that based on the Mark Blitzstein musical, or is it about the kind of actors who were in the musical?
Both. It takes place and it climaxes the night of the opening of the Blitzstein musical.
Oh, so it's about the making of the musical.
Right. It's just, I'm told that it was at the Cannes Festival the other night, and it got the longest standing ovation any film's ever had gotten. But then I read the paper today, they didn't win anything. So I don't know what, maybe it wasn't in competition, maybe it was just being shown.
So tell us a little bit about the story and who you play in it.
Well, I'm a creation of the writer, Tim Robbins, who is also the director. I play a ventriloquist whose job in the Federal Theater Project, which is the time period that we're talking about, is to teach the next generation of ventriloquists. And since their vaudeville is dying rapidly at that moment, dying very quickly at that time, there's not really going to be any place for these ventriloquists to go anyway. But I've got some ventriloquists, or guys that want to be ventriloquists, that don't understand that your mouth can't move when you're talking, you know. So I'm having a lot of trouble. And I'm basically kind of a cranky old vaudevillian ventriloquist.
Did you have to learn ventriloquism for the role?
Well, I learned some. Yeah, I got so I was okay at it. I mean, it's... And it occurred to me that if I wanted to do it, I could do it, you know. But you just have to practice and practice and practice. I got so I was pretty good at it, and I got so that the voice was all right, and I could not move my lips, and I learned some of the tricks about it. I mean, the comedy of it is harder than anything, I think, but the business of it is just really a matter of as technique and just practicing over and over.
This really shows, in a way, how show business has changed. When I was growing up in the 50s, a lot of the old vaudevillians were still on the variety shows, like the Ed Sullivan Show. Mm-hmm. And there were ventriloquists even, like, on the Howdy Doody Show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a kid, I mean, I guess everybody tried to figure out, oh, can I do that? Can I, you know, speak without my lips moving? And I don't think kids today watching TV would feel compelled to learn ventriloquism. You wouldn't see a ventriloquist, I don't think.
Well, you'd think it's just a special effect.
That's true, you would.
You would think that it was re-recorded. I mean, there are commercials where they do ventriloquism and they do spectacular, unbelievable things, so you wouldn't think anything of it unless you saw it live.
But, you know, I'm wondering if you grew up with the other vaudeville things. I was watching a rerun of the Mickey Mouse Club the other night. Mm-hmm. So here's all these kids in the 50s, and, like, for the talent roundup song, they're doing this, like, tap dance and just doing all these really vaudevillian kinds of moves that have nothing to do with their generation. But the generation of showbiz people working with them were bringing in all of their generation stuff. And it was just fascinating to watch this totally out-of-date performance style being done by kids.
Well, it's cruel. Yeah, it is cruel. I mean, there are some people that think line dancing is cruel, to teach that to children, you know?
what do you mean,
my boy was doing the electric slide last night, you know?
But did you grow up watching a kind of generation of performers that were going to be just incredibly outdated by the time you grew up, but you were trying to emulate them?
Well, I saw the Mickey Mouse Club, and I remember Doreen and all those babes doing crazy kinds of dance routines that were nutty, you know, and I think one of them graduated to the Lawrence Welk show and ended up dancing on that show. But they did all kinds of things, and you thought, gosh, if only I could be a Mouseketeer, but I wouldn't want to do what he does, or I wouldn't want to do what she does. It seemed like they were overqualified for jobs that weren't going to exist when they became adults, so you're absolutely right. But I don't know what you would do if you were trying to train somebody now. I mean, it's like watching, you know, pageant kids or something. What are they practicing for? I don't know. What are they trying to figure out here? I don't know what they're trying to learn. I highly recommend tap dancing. Tap dancing is really a lot of fun.
Did you learn it? It's fun to do.
Well, there was one time when we had this gigantic cast at the Second City in Chicago where everybody was over 6 feet. We were called the Seven Giant Goyim or something like that. We were these big giants. And we decided to do a tap dance number because we thought it would be the most frightening thing to be on this stage and just come down stage and tap on our wooden stage, because it would be like a Gatling gun right in front of the audience, and we would sort of overpower them. And we took tap dancing lessons for about 6 weeks, but nothing ever came of it. But it just makes you laugh doing the steps. You just start laughing a lot. And you sweat a lot, too. It's quite a workout. I think that Tai Bo guy is probably going to, like, have a tap dance. Somebody should have a tap dance video infomercial, and they could do well with it. But it's that's the only thing I know how to do. I mean, I can sing, and my few tap dancing steps I do repeatedly over and over again, just like I can play just a few notes on the piano, and when I walk through a room, I play those notes, you know, the Rhapsody in Blue, and then I walk away like, and I always like, act like the piano's out of tune, and then walk away, and people go, oh, no, go on, please. No.
My guest is Bill Murray. His new book is called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Murray, the star of such films as Rushmore, Kingpin, and Groundhog Day. In his days on Saturday Night Live, he was famous for his merciless imitations of bad lounge singers. When we left off, we were talking about the generation gap in entertainment and some of the old-fashioned and often bad performers he used to watch on TV when he was a kid. I figured the inspiration for his character, Nick the Lounge Singer, must have come in part from watching bad singers on TV. I think one of the alienating things about hearing some of the songs sung when I was a kid is that they were sung by singers on the Ed Sullivan Show with sequin gowns and big phony smiles on their faces, belting it out, and just really ruining some great songs.
Well, it was a different generation of song ruiners, I guess. They ruined them differently in those days.
That's right. But you must have loved that stuff in a good, bad way because, I mean, you can mock it so well.
Well, you have to, I guess, I enjoy mocking it, but you have to see where the original center of it was and how they destroy it, you know. It's the ruining of the good song that is that you want to recreate. You know, it's not the song itself is as good or bad as it is, but it's even sometimes the original singer of the song doesn't sing it as well. You know, sometimes his version of the song is the worst version. You know, he just got it first, but you have to like the stuff, and you have to, I guess, you have to know that when you have the song and you have the microphone, you have the opportunity to touch somebody. And when you don't do it with the lyric or the power of it, but you do it with your own excuse for technique comes in and steps on top of it. That's what I guess what I object to and what I want to mimic.
You've really studied that so well.
Well, I'm a good listener, I guess, and I always think when you have the opportunity, of course, I'm very much aware of it now, I have an opportunity to say something. What am I saying? I'm saying, well, I like to watch bad entertainers, and I get a kick out of imitating them. But, you know, bad entertainment gets jammed down your throat all the time. You know, it's forced down your throat. And like you talk about the Sullivan Show, there was this case where it was the biggest show in America. It was on once a week, and people fought like dogs for that spot on the show. And they, you know, when they got their spot, they went out there, you know, with all the energy they possibly could have and just blasted themselves, you know, through the screen at people, you know, sometimes losing control, I think. And, you know, you can see where that just the desire for success or just the fear space that you could get into backstage at the Sullivan would make you mad. I had the occasion to play Carnegie Hall, I actually got to sing at Carnegie Hall last month. And as part of a benefit for a rainforest thing. And I was asked to do it because it was a Sinatra theme, and they couldn't find anybody to do My Way. And they felt it was important to have My Way in the show. So I got the call like 2 days before, and I thought, am I going to really do this, sing with these guys? These are real singers going to be. You know, it's like Tony Bennett, Elton John, you know, Sting, Don Henley. These guys can actually show up. And then I thought, well, hell, when's the last time anybody asked me to sing at Carnegie Hall? So I did it. But the anxiety I felt backstage, I mean, I thought I'd swallowed a goose. I mean, there was just nothing between my solar plexus and my throat for about 13 minutes before I went on stage. I just didn't think I was going to make it. But it all turned out okay. It had a happy ending. But boy, just the anxiety of having to go out there. I'd never had anything quite like that, of feeling, oh my God, am I in over my head this time?
So what did you do with the song?
I murdered it. I absolutely killed it. I went out. It was like 2/3 of the way through the show. It was after the intermission, and I went out, no introduction, you know, in the dark, and I had this full orchestra behind me, and I couldn't talk, my dry mouth, you know, bad bladder, everything going wrong all at once, falling apart. And then when I hit the stage, I just sort of, channeled Frank, I guess. I don't know. All of a sudden it just happened, you know. I just started becoming the guy, and they start playing that music for My Way. And, with a full orchestra, you know, we could all pull it off almost, you know. I mean, it gives you a lot of, backing. And I started singing the notes, and I can sing. So people later said, we thought you were lip-syncing because it was so good, Terry. It was that good. But I started lip-syncing, and then I basically rewrote the lyrics and changed them around to suit my own mood. And I started getting laughs with it, and then I was off the click track. I mean, there's a full orchestra playing to its own chart, so they just keep playing, you know. And the fact that I'm off the lyric and talking and doing things, it doesn't matter to them. They don't keep vamping. Like, it's not like a piano bar. They just keep going to the end. So I said to the audience, I said, let's see if this big band's going to stay with me here. And they didn't. They just kept barreling right ahead. But I managed to catch them at the pass. I headed them off at the pass and turned it around and got out of it at the end. And it was huge. It was a big deal.
What were your lyrics?
Oh, I can't remember. But I said, I don't know. I just changed them. I changed everything. that were elegant dames. You know, stuff like that. You know, just to, hey, Jack, you know, a lot of that, and yelling at the band. Hey, louder! You know, stuff like that. And some of these chicks were a bit more than I could, you know, that, you know, anything. So it, I had a lot of fun doing it. It was really fun.
Bill Murray, his new book is called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. This is Fresh Air.